Welcome to the Cinematologist Podcast. I'm Dario Linares, and down the line again is Dr. Neil Fox. Neil, good to speak to you again.
I know, long time no speak. What is that, 30 seconds or something?
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny how the old the podcasting double up recording, suddenly time and space seem to go out of the window, don't they?
They collapse on each other like they do in a Nicholas Rogue film.
Yeah, and well, maybe our listeners will have, you know, been listening in completely, they will have been completely different times and completely different spaces. So wherever you are, if you've listened to our previous episode on film philosophy and there's a gap in between, our gap has been non-existent. So we're straight into our next of our double extravaganza at the beginning of season 8. And in this episode, I was very lucky to be invited to host a Q&A with the director of a newly released film, American Animals. So the director's name was Bart Layton. And yeah, I spoke to him at the Picture Houses Cinema in Brighton. And we have that conversation coming up. I mean, I really enjoyed the film. And I think that Neil, maybe I don't know whether you enjoyed it quite as much as me, but I know you've got lots of interesting stuff to say about it. But before we get to that, I think because the last episode was very academically focused, I know that you wanted to talk about some of the stuff that you've been watching, that you've been sent to review, which has been quite a lot of stuff, actually, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's been a really lovely summer in terms of watching a lot of different films, a lot of different kinds of films, and really, yeah, re-engaging with reading and watching, which has been really rewarding. And yeah, there's been a kind of slew of releases from Eureka and Masters of Cinema that I've managed to spend some time with that has been really, really great. And the other night I started to watch one of those kind of next generation Canadian films on Mubi, which
yeah,
I've largely enjoyed most of them, but there was one, I won't name it, which I started and I just thought, I just can't do it. You know, like I couldn't do the work. I don't know if it's tired, kind of preterm. I couldn't do the work. And so then kind of just stopped watching it because I thought I'm not in it. And kind of switched the Andromeda Strain, which we'll talk about in a little bit. But the stuff that I've seen from our cinema was just really, really great because it was different types of what I would call intelligent entertainment in different ways, you know, and a whole gamut. So they are re-releasing really beautiful editions of Paul Verhoeven's Flesh and Bone with Rutger Hauer and Jennifer Jason Leigh. And they're releasing a beautiful edition of Jackie Chan's Police Story and Police Story 2 and Billy Wilder's Witness for the Prosecution. All films that in different ways kind of set out to entertain an audience, but do it without what I think without kind of, you know, pandering or patronizing or kind of speaking down. There's a real craft to each of them and a real kind of intelligence. And it was just great to see really beautiful versions of these films which I hadn't seen in a long time. And in the case of Police Story 2, hadn't seen before at all. So yeah, kind of wonderful. And so many thoughts on all of them, really. I mean, Flesh and Bone is, you know, like it's adult fantasy, which is not a genre that I'm not interested in fantasy, really. So adult fantasy seems even more, but it was kind of refreshing to see a film that realized that these, you know, these films are kind of mad and bonkers and to see something that was in that kind of realm of medieval kind of sorcery and fighting that was aimed at adults in its violence and sex rather than, you know, repressed and regressive adults, you know, by kind of being films that they should have got bored of. It seemed like an interesting way of kind of taking the kind of stories that people like when they're young and kind of serving up for an adult audience. It's very schlocky. And Rutger Hauer chews every piece of scenery, both kind of animal, vegetable and mineral in the entire, but it's so fun and kind of, yeah, just hadn't seen that in a long time. I hadn't seen a film like it in a while. Because I think films like that now that kind of are aimed at adult audiences, something like Nicholas Refn's Valhalla Rising, which I love, kind of skew on the philosophical existential, whereas this is proper sword and sandals, you know, X-rated. So well worth checking out. Saw Police Story and Police Story 2 around the time that everyone was talking about Mission Impossible Fallout and kind of Tom Cruise as the new Jackie Chan. And it kind of made sense, you know, watching him do these crazy stunts and then going back to see Jackie Chan do it. I mean, some of the stuff in Police Story is
insane.
Just outrageous.
Yeah,
outrageous. You know, what craftsmanship, you know, real Buster Keaton,
yeah,
artistry of physical screen performance.
Is it Police Story that's got that bus chase?
Yeah.
That's mental, isn't it? Yeah.
That comes out of this, where all these cars drive through this hillside village and just destroy the entire village. I mean, it's just exhilarating. You know, just the spectacle of it. I think I watched Police Story 2 too close to the first one. It felt like they were trying to make it a proper film, which, you know, kind of the serious stuff and the kind of the long sequences of the story, I guess, were just really detracted from, I think, people came to see. There's too much going on. And a lot of the action felt very, very similar to the first one. And I think, you know, it didn't feel as innovative and as exciting as Police Story did. But yeah, still enjoyable and still some moments where you're just like, I can't believe that a human being is doing this. And just, as we sort of talked about with Cruise, you know, like when we did our bonus on Mission Impossible, like part of the thrill of it for me is watching a screen and thinking that this is a human being doing this, you know, and not only, but a star like Cruise, but Jackie Chan is actually, you can see him doing it and you just can't believe how he's doing it. And he's literally being dragged along by a bus. It's extraordinary. Yeah, great fun. And then I love Billy Wilder. So, you know, watching Dietrich and Charles Laughton in Witness for the Prosecution. And again, just how those kind of great Hollywood directors could take theatrical material, largely set in a courtroom and the offices around, you know, and make it feel so cinematic in the way it kind of really understands the claustrophobia of the situation and the way it hides the story and the kind of the resolutions almost in plain sight and really deftly handles the mechanics of the plot is just wonderful. Yeah, so all recommended.
Fantastic stuff. Yeah, no, thanks very much. You've sent me the discs for those, and unfortunately with beginning of term I haven't had time to watch them yet, but I'll definitely check those out. Well, for me, actually, after I've finished taping with you, I'm going to tape a bonus with a friend of the podcast and a listener, Chiara Salavi. And we're going to talk about Cold War, which I've seen twice now, which, you know, I'm not going to go on about it because I want to talk about it on the bonus episode. So if you want to listen to that, you can subscribe. But it's really going to vie for my film of the year with maybe one other film at the moment. It's just such an amazing film. I really love Ida, but, you know, when you're just in the mood for something. And when I saw the trailer for this, I just kind of, I'm going to like this film.
And I did.
So I saw that. So highly recommended if you can get, obviously it's the release is not as big as, you know, a Mission Impossible film, but if you can get to it, please get to it at the cinema. It's superb. And I watched this Polish sci-fi that's on movie, Avalon.
I haven't seen that yet.
From the director of Ghost in the Shell, Mamori Oshii, I think you pronounce that. And it's very much a sort of post-Matrix cyberpunk meets Tarkovsky, you know, with the whole, I mean, an interesting sort of Polish language film, but made by this director who's Japanese. And yeah, really sort of odd piece of work. And, you know, it goes back to the sort of early internet days with this sort of whole cyberpunk subculture thing going on, where the internet was seen as this other dimension, you know, back in the day when we know it has become that. But I don't think it's become that in the way that the cyberpunkistas thought it was gonna be. But an interesting kind of experiment, I think, that it isn't a film that I would say, oh yeah, you're going to sit down and really enjoy this and be sort of gripped by it in the same way as, I mean, I think most people were with The Matrix. You know, its special effects are very much of that dot Matrix ilk, which is quite fun to watch. And again, I think it doesn't get into kind of like the philosophical questions of identity and existing in different dimensions in the way that it perhaps could. But I'm always interested to see non-Western sci-fi. I think it really is. There's a wealth of interesting material there that you can look at. And it's definitely worth checking out. And then both of us recently have seen The Andromeda Strain, which, you know, when I saw that come up on MUBI, I thought, do you know, I don't even know if I've actually seen that. But I love 70s sci-fi, you know, I love the weirdness of it all, but I didn't actually enjoy this as much as I thought I was going to do. It felt like a film that never got away from its kind of didacticism about procedures, because it was about this bug that had come from outer space that was spread, you know, and they didn't know how it was spreading, so it was all a bit like these dystopian or these disaster movies where you see them trying to contain a disease, and you know, and there's always a moment where the disease spreads where it shouldn't do, and how do they stop that from happening? So the, but it never felt like it got out of that mode into anything sort of narrative. How did you feel about it, Neil?
Yeah, no, it definitely felt at times like a really long explanation about how great science is, and what, and the importance of, you know, the scientific process and diligence, which I thought was amazing, because you've got in the film, you've got this president sitting on, you know, off screen, just, you know, saying he doesn't trust science. And I'm thinking, well, you know, we've got a president who just, you know, left the Paris Agreement in the world, you know, and you just, it felt very now, and it felt like a timely to put it up, like, you know, science is important, science matters, but it did feel very, and at times kind of detrimental to the flow of the story, because it had to stay in the process, had to stay in the reality rather than kind of taking a lot of storytelling liberties. And in a way, that felt like a film by a filmmaker towards the end of their career. You know, it felt very rigid in a way that some filmmakers can get, where they're kind of tied to their idea, you know. And, you know, this is a filmmaker who made absolute classics. Not only that, you know, one of the great early science fiction films with The Day the Earth Stood Still. So it had moments, and it is still, it was very watchable. You know, the performance is very good. Everyone's all in, you know, and there's something about the amount of things that were going on. I was wondering, how is this all going to kind of tie together? And it doesn't really. It just sort of ends. And then there's a big gap between like the end of the drama and the kind of this Senate hearing coda, which is, it just leaves so many questions kind of unanswered.
It's a wonderfully politically incorrect sexual politics throughout, as absolutely, you would expect from 70s sci-fi.
Absolutely. And just brilliant, where a surgeon just says to the lead, you know, when they're kind of, you know, just look at his buttocks, you know. And I was just like, that is amazing. Like, So, yeah, some really, really nice stuff. And again, just, it felt like there was more going on, but it was just a kind of straightforward watch. But definitely lesser, minor kind of 70s sci-fi, but did make me think again about Robert Wise, a filmmaker who's, you know, I think been undervalued, and this won't change anybody's opinion if they don't think he's great, unfortunately.
No, that's true.
But again, lots of good ideas, and kind of I did like the way it kind of built drama out of containment, you know, just the focus on this thing in this room and what might happen if this thing gets out, and it's kind of getting out. You know, I thought some of it was really well handled. Yeah, so enjoyable.
Yeah, I mean, if you're into scientific experiments in real time in a Hollywood movie, then it's definitely the film for you. Okay, so let's move on to our main portion of the podcast. So this is me in conversation with the director, Bart Layton, about his latest release, American Animals.
You ever feel like you're waiting for something to happen?
It pains me to see you embarrass your father.
But you don't know what it is.
You're in, or you're out.
That thing that could make your life special.
You're in, or you're out. You're in. Oh, you're out.
How can I tell you if I'm in or I'm out without you telling me the first thing about what I might be in or out of?
This would be something dangerous and very exciting.
Boom, boom. This library is home to the most valuable book in the United States.
$12 million. You really need to see how easy this is gonna be.
Oh, you know this from all your previous heists?
Can I just say how dumb this entire thing is?
How do you know no one's gonna get hurt?
I don't want you waking up years from now wondering what could have happened and who you could have been.
Are you sure you're okay?
Come on!
Oh, shit.
This is my life. This isn't some game.
Can you please not touch? the model things. Let's do this.
Ladies and gentlemen, Bart Layton, director of American Nightmare. Thank you. This table is rather large.
Thanks for staying, guys.
Well, congratulations.
Oh, thanks, man.
Fantastic film. I really enjoyed it. Really sort of slick, smart, and entertaining, but, you know, with a lot more to it than that. And I just watched your first film the other day, The Imposter, and there's lots of similarities, which maybe we can kind of come to a little bit later on. But maybe you could sort of talk a bit about how you came to this story. Maybe, you know, it's sort of, what, 6 years after your first feature, and, you know, what really drew you to it, apart from it being really interesting? Yeah.
I found the story in a magazine, and I was on a flight, I think, in my memory, and I'm this, again, like all memories, it might not be that reliable, but in my mind, I was on the way back from Sundance, having shown The Imposter, and thinking about what I was going to do next and what have you, and then found this story of this very kind of misguided comedy of errors sort of heist, and I thought it was fun, and but I didn't think there was anything, it was necessarily anything more than that. I thought it was just, you know, it's a great story, and, you know, and not least the fact that all of the elements of the heist were so unexpected, you know, the target being these books and the people who did it being these pretty well-to-do young men who'd come from good homes and well-educated. And that there was just this thing at the heart of it that just didn't add up. And then I came back and I tried to read up more on it, and it still didn't really answer this question of, you know, what were they thinking? You know, that was the thing that I was like, I couldn't quite figure out, because it seemed obvious that it was never going to end well. And it seemed unlikely that even if it did end well, you know, how would they get rid of the books? What would they do with the money? If they did get all the money, what were they going to just, like, hide it under the bed? You know, it was like, none of it added. So, coming from Docs, I thought, well, maybe I'll just ask them. And we tracked them down, and they were in different prisons. They'd all been split up. And I started writing to them, and
did you have it in your mind just to be a doc to start with?
I didn't even really know what it was. At that point, I was just kind of intrigued to understand sort of the why of it. And then when we started researching, it turned out that there'd been an article in Vanity Fair, and a big Hollywood producer sort of bought the rights to that, and we couldn't really tell it anyway. And so we allowed this sort of weird correspondence where they would write in tiny, you know, they had limited pages of kind of these legal binders that they have in prison, and they would write back, and it was the things that they wrote in those letters which turned it from a good yarn to, oh, this is actually really a story of our time. This is a story about these lost young men searching for an identity, and, you know, having been raised on an expectation that they were going to be interesting and important, and that their lives were going to be special, and actually that need to leave a mark on the world, regardless of whether it was a good mark or a bad mark, you know, but just do something, felt quite modern to me. And that's why I thought, oh, well, maybe, you know, we still get to deliver on the fun of and the tropes of a heist movie, but actually we can talk about this other thing.
Sure. So when you're doing your research into the actual characters, and, you know, you're having the letters with them, then eventually, obviously, you're meeting them, and you're setting up interviews, I would imagine pre-interviews before filming and stuff like that. I'm just thinking about how that works in terms of the correlation of writing the fictionalization of it, which obviously you had to do. So would you have had interview descriptions that they gave, and you're like, ah, oh, that will make a great scene, or did it kind of, one came after the other, or was it sort of parallel?
Yeah, no, it was all, I started writing the screenplay kind of based on the letters, and I had four different sets of letters from the four guys, and often they didn't add up, and that started to make me think, well, actually, is there a way of telling this in a way which sort of exposes not just that we've got unreliable narrators, but that memory is pretty unreliable, and
yeah,
sort of lean into that, make a virtue of it, and also slightly pull the curtain back on how stories, true stories, get fictionalized and Hollywoodized and warped, and so all of that. So I wrote the screenplay with their voices in it, the real guys, based on what they'd said in their letters. And then, of course, when they finally came out of prison, I got to sit down and shoot the interviews. They didn't say half the things that I'd written in the script. And so I was like, oh, man, right. how? But at that point, I kind of got the money and we were off to the races. But the last thing you want to do is turn your documentary contributors into actors, because then you remove the thing that they're there to do, which is be natural and authentic, you know.
But it seems to me that Warren really wanted to be an actor.
Yeah,
I mean, he was loving it, wasn't he, all the time?
I mean, Warren is that, you know, people ask whether he really is like, I mean, you know, if he was here now, we'd all be up to God knows what. He's like, he's that kind of force of nature. And and even though I think you see, and, you know, some people have commented at question whether those tears are real, that, you know, that he cries. But I absolutely, you know, in shooting the, I absolutely believe they were. And I think he lives at a very high frequency. He experiences big highs and big lows. And that's how it goes.
I mean, it was interesting before the screening came on, you kind of told everybody that, you know, they are the real people.
Yeah.
And when I first watched it on the screener that the production company sent, I didn't know that. And it was almost as if the documentary parts could have been acted as well. So there was a lot about that performance of self and relates to the idea of subjectivity and memory. And then even at the end, you know, Warren's still questioning whether he's leaving us open to interpretation about whether he went to Holland or not. So it's like, you know, it's still playing around with all of that all the time.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, if you're writing a conventional screenplay based on a true story, you don't really have to, you know, I showed the script to lots of people who are what I considered to be like real screenwriters who are, and they would say things like, well, what, you know, this is, you just need to get rid of one of the characters, make it three, it's way easier, it's cleaner, it's neat, you know. And of course, I felt that it was really important to kind of preserve the truth, or as best we can understand the truth, and where we can't be sure about it, to kind of be fairly open about that, be fairly honest about it,
sure.
I guess.
And when it comes to the casting of the actors, did you do that through casting sessions? I mean, did you see sort of like Brian Deegan before? I mean, I'd seen him in Killing of a Sacred Deer, and he's got an amazing face, but then I hadn't seen the actor who played Warren before.
No, you know, there was a point where I wrote the script and then it got sent off into the kind of the ether of, you know, people who are going to finance the movie, but also, you know, agents get hold of everything, regardless of how it's watermarked, you know, whatever, and it goes out and it gets photocopied and it get, you know. I was just talking to Andy, who's from STX, and he was talking about, you know, when they got to see a script for a Scorsese film, and it's all printed on kind of aluminium paper, so it can't be photocopied. Well, I mean, that's a rare thing, but this script just went everywhere, and suddenly we had the option of casting the hottest actors of this age group. Mm. Suddenly, you know, they were coming out of big franchise movies, and I always felt that really wasn't what the film wanted and what I wanted, and so I just sort of went through this process of just auditioning, and, you know, and amongst them some very big names, and Evan, who I hadn't really wasn't familiar with, but he's Quicksilver in X-Men, and he's, you know, he just came in and did this unbelievable audition, and it was sort of, so it's kind of the process of how you put a heist together. You know, you sort of find your charismatic leader, your Danny Ocean character, and then from that, and then there's a big thing now of self-taping. You know, actors can get hold of a part of the script and they'll send a tape that they record on their iPhones. So you get all of these, and then the casting director will send you the ones that she thinks are promising.
Okay.
And Barry sent one, and it was like, who the hell is this guy? And the problem was, he looked about 12, so I was like, well, I'm never going to be able to cast him because he's just... But I couldn't stop thinking about it, and then...
And that's before seeing, knowing that it was who he was in terms of...
Yeah, I mean, I didn't even know, you know, the accent was flawless. He's got the most... He's got the broadest Dublin accent you've ever heard. And it was, you know, he sent this tape in, And I then I found myself coming back to him again and again, and in the end bought him from Dublin and Evan from LA, and we did a chemistry test in New York, and they were like, it was great.
Fantastic. So just going back again to the sort of documentary versus fictionalization question, you've come from documentary, so everybody's got those friends who are kind of like, their critical response to films are, well, that would never happen. And, you know, maybe there's some people like that here tonight, but it's, you seem to be drawn to these stories, if you take your first film, that seem incredulous. So is there a sense in which this combination of fictionalization and documentary, you know, the way that they're cut together, is the way to sort of play around with that idea of this is an incredulous story? If you just fictionalized it, maybe you wouldn't buy it, but the documentary element actually gives that sort of underpinning, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I think for me the starting point is always, you know, it's kind of, there's two essential bits, which are, is it a ripping yarn? Is it a kind of like, what happened? Does it have that constant what's going to happen thing? But equally important is that, does it actually get into sort of a conversation that you might have in the pub, or is there something else? You know, with The Imposter, for me, that was equally a story about self-deception as it was about deception. And this felt to me like a story of, you know, which had all... You know, I think we're in a culture now where increasingly the pressure is to be a somebody. You know, I mean, we've got that strap line on the poster, nobody wants to be ordinary. And, you know, now we carry around these devices which facilitate a kind of metric of how important or interesting you are, and so that idea of doing something to leave a mark, even if it's not a great mark, you know, I thought felt very current. And you know, and Spencer, his main problem is that he doesn't have a problem, and that felt like a great starting point for a character. Yeah. And in answer to your question, you know, the thing about putting the two together for me was like, if you didn't have that, it was quite a disposable story. You know, it's not a big story. It's not really an important story. But you add in that element where the audience is constantly, you know, you're not allowed to go off into movie world.
Yeah.
You're just constantly like, whatever happens to these guys, that's what really would happen in real life. And I think you have a slightly different engagement with them and with the story, and you're able to participate in a different way. Sure. That was the gamble, anyway. Sure.
And with the sort of heist portion of the film, you're obviously, I think there's two options that you can take with that when you're dealing with sort of genre filmmaking, I think. And one is that you sort of ignore that the genre exists and just make it, or you riff on the films that have contributed to that genre, and you've taken the latter option. So I'm just wondering about your thinking around that, where you were like, you know, we've got to sort of play on these films.
Oh, totally, because
watching.
I felt like it was about, I felt like the thing they fell in love with was not, we're going to get these books and we're going to be rich. It was, they were just playing in this movie fantasy, and they got more and more invested. You know, Eric, the character played by Jared Abramson in the movie, said to me in one of his, the real one, he said to me in a letter, you know, he's like, this was our version of Fight Club. This was our secret that we had that no one else knew about, that set us apart from everyone. And I thought, you know, that's what it was. They all were like addicted to this fantasy. No one wanted to burst the bubble. And Warren was creating, kind of, he was the architect of the fantasy, creating all of these stories, which may or may not be true. And so for me, it was about finding a form to the movie that reflected that. So actually, you know, we start in a place of relative naturalism, and as they get deeper into the planning and the plotting and the fantasy, the grammar of the movie starts to change. We get a bit more Ocean's 11, we get a bit more Steadicam, we get the score is more orchestral, it's bigger, up until the point where they cross the line and we're kind of plummeted. Literally that moment where he touches her, the colour we pulled out, all of that fancy stuff that you do to make a movie look beautiful, you know, it's handheld for the majority of the rest. You know, it's a different... it was kind of like, let's lean into the thing so that we can also kind of be complicit in a way, maybe against our better judgment, I guess.
I'll just ask one more question and then I'll open it out to the audience. So, I mean, you have sort of touched on this already in terms of the sort of correlation to what's going on in society right now, and without sort of going on off on a big riff about toxic masculinity and stuff like that. Mm. You know, how much were you aware of that and wanted that to be kind of like the canvas on which the film was made, and how much were you where's the balance between that and making it an entertaining film that's not, you know, teaching us things, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think there was probably a draft of the script where I went way too far into the kind of the whole meta thing. You know, at one point I think there was a draft where I had the real people involved in auditioning, the people who were they were going to be played by, and there was a lot more about the whole. You know, I got really into that whole Darwinian thing because there were so many, you know, the fact they stole and this whole thing was about having evolved past the point of being able to survive in the Darwinian state. It's just consuming and Facebooking and all of that, you know. So I think there were lots where I was probably trying to spoon feed too much of the themes or the message or whatever. And so I guess you just have to hope that in the course of serving the story, you keep a clear enough perspective on what ultimately it's about. Mm. Because I think the movie that was in the works when I first happened, which was based on the Vanity Fair article, was going to be a kind of Pineapple Express, sort of like 21, sort of bling ring, really glossy, right? Like, you know, and I felt like that wouldn't have been the way to go, I guess.
Great. I'll try and spot any hands up if anybody wants to ask a question. Is there any chance you could turn the lights up if anybody's listening? Because I really can't see anything.
Yeah, it's spotlights. Weird, isn't it?
Oh, there's one in the middle there. Is that a gentleman in the middle? Go ahead, sir. Just 1 second. Do we have a roving mic at all? Just so we can hear you. If you can shout loud, you can start now if you want.
So you were saying that there was there's a pressure to be somebody, and they expressed that literally in the film. That they're trying to find an identity, which I thought was similar to Frederick in The Imposter, who literally lost an identity. I was wondering if there was a part that was consciously drawn to these characters, especially Warren, who, because they were so similar to Frederick. I know you said there was a Vanity Fair article, but I was wondering if that was part of the process as well.
So the question was whether I was drawn to Warren or drawn to them because of the similarity to Frederick?
Pretty much.
Yeah, no, I mean, like, the Frederick experience would last me a lifetime. But weirdly you should say that, because there definitely was a point during the interview with Warren where I felt some sort of flashback to Frederick a little bit, you know, in his ability, you know, in that they're both sort of fantasists. And their ability to kind of weave that story for you and make you sympathize for them, and despite the fact that they'd done things which were really, I guess, misguided and morally certainly quite lost in terms of, you know, his sort of compass. I think he got very lost. But it wasn't actually. Because this was going to be an inversion of the Imposter was a doc with these sort of heightened dramatic elements, and this was always going to be a drama with, you know, I really thought about this more, I guess, less as real guys and actors, more as like older guys and younger guys, and that it was going to try and sit, you know, as a whole in that way.
And you had that interesting scene where you actually, I mean, you were talking about the whole meta element, where you put the actor and the real guy in the car for that split second where he asked him a question. So, you know, you're sort of crossing over those lines about where the subjectivity lies, if that's not too pretentious.
Yeah, and also just, you know, all of those kind of things and, you know, tricks or whatever you want to call them came out organically from the process of writing or making the movie, where, you know, the actors are saying, is that really, is this how it happened? And so me thinking, well, wouldn't it be interesting if he asked the real person that, in a scene from his own memory.
Yeah.
But it's not even his memory, it's his mate's memory, and it turns out that's not how he remembers it.
Yeah. Sure. Any other questions? There's just one in the middle there, and then one a bit further back. So,
just, do, just a
go ahead.
Go back to the Vanity Fair thing. When you came to, when you discovered the project, someone's got the rights to it, it's going to be this bigger thing. How do you kind of run that project off the rails and get yours in first? Is it just a race against the clock, or do you actually have to negotiate them out of making the big Hollywood movie and into your idea of what you want to do?
Yeah, right. So the question is, how did I edge out the big Hollywood production? And, well, you can't. I mean, life rights are life rights, and that's, you know, I was doing other things and working on other things, and so this was sort of bubbling away in the background, but kept in touch with them in the event that didn't happen, you know. And like, as you guys probably know, you know, I don't know what percentage of scripts that get written actually get produced, so there's a high possibility that it will come back around, and sure enough, you know, they ended up writing and saying, look, that thing's not going to happen, and we've now got the option of renewing the option with them, or if you're interested in doing it, we'd rather do it with you. And I said, well, look, I don't have, we're not going to pay you, we haven't got Hollywood money, we haven't got that kind of, but if you're, yeah, I'd still love to tell the story. So it was really just a kind of a long game, I guess, is the way. But, you know, I once, you know, on a separate thing, I once asked an IP lawyer about, because, you know, there were two competitive projects, and often, you know, like, you've got two Lance Armstrong stories, you know, and they're literally neck and neck, and all he said was, be first and be fast. You can spend all the money you can, you know, trying to lock down the intellectual property and sue people, but actually you just got to get on with it, I think.
Sure. And there was, yep, just in the middle at the back. Oh, we have a mic now, sorry.
Thank you very much.
Hello.
Hey.
So as I was saying, we play a lot with narrative point of view in this film and also in The Imposter. And I was wondering if there's, how it was that you came about with those ideas. Are they ideas that came to you when you first got those letters, or was it something that kind of developed over time? And also, part two, sorry about this, is there a point of view that you wish you had included in this film that didn't make it to the final cut?
Interesting.
Good questions. So the first part of the question, all of those devices really come out of the process of, I guess, trying to translate different people's memories of the same events, which often can be conflicting, you know, and so, you know, if it was a straight screenplay, you'd just choose one version, you know, and if you're a producer, you just choose the cheap version, and if you're the cinematographer, you choose the cool, you know, like, and whereas with this, I kind of thought, you know, we have to, I guess, find ways to slightly clue the audience in on, you know, the unreliability of those memories, and also planting seeds of, you know, how much of this was a fantasy that Warren created for them all to play in a way. So it was really those things of coming out and like having those conversations and talking to actors and them really wanting to understand whether they were really, and of course when you're writing dialogue, I'm dreaming that up, but they've all seen it, the real guys, and they all feel it's unbelievably close to their memory of it. The interesting thing that then starts to happen is, and this happened with The Imposter as well, is this movie is starting to replace their real memories of what happened. You know, they're now, this is their version of it, and that's the really kind of weird thing. It always just a pretty organic thing of thinking about, you know, how do you take those two things and sit them in a, what, you know, invite, you know, the audience to sort of, because I think we're in a place where we're sophisticated enough to know that, you know, Natalie Portman's not actually Jackie Kennedy. You know, we know what the game is, so why don't we all just put our cards on the table and you know. And
but is this film not also saying that we are in a time where, you know, to use a cliched phrase, we're in this post-truth fake news world where even the cues of documentary, that, you know, the notion of the document, the filmed reality, is something that is questioned now, and again, it seems to me sort of post the act of killing, something like that, which really plays around with documentary film. Yeah. Well, actually, these are just ways of presenting a truth.
So, you know, the truth is that conversation should always have been had. I mean, you know, documentary truth is a whole other conversation about, you know, I mean, it, you know, as soon as you've spent time in an edit suite, you know, it is a very, very subjective process, you know, and no one sets out to make a boring film, you know, and so you're always leading and guiding and doing all of that stuff. And as soon as you bring music in, you're giving suggestions. And so I guess it was, you know, I'm a little bit fed up with watching those movies which are based on a true story, and then at the end you see a few pictures of the real person and you Google furiously, you know, what they really like. And how much in the middle was actually anything remotely real? Yeah. I don't know. The second part of, was there a voice I chose not to, POV I wanted to include but couldn't?
Yes.
Not really. There was a brilliant FBI investigator who gave us all of the FBI files, and he was an amazing character. And that was very seductive to kind of get into, you know, do a kind of catch me if you can sort of. And I just thought that's just not this story, you know. The only person who, without whom, either whose participation or whose blessing, I wouldn't have made the film was the librarian. She didn't want to take part. She didn't know what it was going to be like. She didn't know what the vision was. And then we spent some time with her and visited her and the books and all the rest of it. And then over time, she realized actually it is a story that she wanted told. And so she not only kind of gave us our blessing, she wanted to be in it. And I did a very long interview with her, and then decided actually I'm going to keep her. And then I watched it with her before Sundance and thought, well, better show her before everyone else. And if there had been things that she had felt misrepresented her, I would have changed them until she was happy. But I wouldn't have done that with the guys, because, you know, they would always have had issues. And but we watched it at her house. She got absolutely smashed. And her husband fell asleep about 20 minutes in. So he obviously, I sat like surrounded by her cats, and she tapped her feet along to the soundtrack and then took all her mates when it came out in the cinema in the States, and said it had helped, it had allowed her to move beyond this whole episode. And she said it even had allowed her to feel forgiveness for them. Wow. For the first time, because she realised in seeing this that they were idiots more than criminals, sort of thing. Felt forgiving.
Can I just say as well that the actress who played the librarian just quietly and subtly kills it in this movie. She's awesome.
I mean, you know, she is one of, she's actually called Anne Dowd, who you guys
been
have
in a lot
seen
of stuff.
There's a movie called Compliance, which I saw her in 5 years ago, and was like, she is the movie. I'd recommend you guys seek that out. Yeah,
and maybe time for a couple more if there are any out there. Just go ahead at the front. Do you want to?
I just
there you go.
I'm just quite curious because obviously you said you wrote the script before the guys got out of jail and you had a chance to kind of like interview them, get to know them, kind of feel a sense of the personalities. And I'm just curious, like, how much of the script that you originally wrote was as accurate to the, was as what close to what you see in the film as
what made it to the final version?
It ended up being very, you know, the final movie is probably closer than any of us imagined it would be in terms of the balance between the doc and the drama. You write something which is unconventional, and you promise everyone who's putting money into it that it's going to work beautifully. And of course, you don't really know until you get into the edit whether that is the case. It's very close. You know, in docs, you spend weeks or months agonizing in the edit, trying to find the story. And I kind of didn't want to, in a movie like this where you're against the clock, you can't muck about. You just have to shoot what's on the page and really hope you get through it. And so I did all of that agonizing at the script stage, really.
And this seems, I mean, it's difficult to edit any movie, but this seems like a very complex edit when you've got all the different kinds of footage and even like the very short cutaways, which are subtle but really important. Like after the heist takes place, you just cut away with no, for a few seconds to the real people and stuff. You know, it's painstaking work, that.
I think, I mean, most of the transitions and most of those things were planned at script stage and were shot in that way.
Right,
so
gotcha.
It was a much more, for me, it was a much more painful script writing process than it was editing.
Maybe one final question. Anybody wants to? Is that it? Okay, maybe. Oh, yep, there we go. Gentleman just on the left there.
What's next for you?
Yes, stole my last one. Yeah.
Because I'm really keen to see more of these kinds of movies. Well done on this one. Nice job on the imposter.
Oh, thank you very much. I'm not sure I'll do another kind of hybrid-y thing. The thing I'm doing next is probably, it will be the first completely fictionalized thing I've done with fancy actors and all of that sort of stuff. And I will try to find a way, I guess part of my objective will be to find a way for the audience to have, to participate and have feel like you've got skin in the game in the way that I think it's so, you see so easily with a documentary, and it's much harder to create with a fiction. So it will be about trying to figure out whether, because it's a story which isn't any more outrageous than this one, but it just happens to be made up. And it's sort of got a Trumpian kind of overtone. It's again, it's about someone who's pretending to be something they're not, but people really want to believe that he's the thing he says he is.
Very good. Very good.
Thank you.
Fantastic.
You're going to put money in.
Thank you very much for your time, Bart.
Pleasure.
Congratulations on the movie. I'm sure it's going to do really well.
Thank you.
Bart,
thank you so much.
Okay, so that was me with the director, Bart Layton. And Neil, you've seen the film also. So, it'd be great to get your take on both the film itself and on what Bart had to say about it.
I really, really enjoyed the film. I thought it was fabulously entertaining and really, really thought-provoking as a piece of cinema where questions about form and story are kind of played around with really, really, in really, really fascinating ways. You know, that I was watching it and I was looking at how he, as a filmmaker, was capturing the documentary side, the way he was kind of choosing to shoot and listen to the people who were at the kind of the heart of the real events, and then the choices to of how that was told. And I thought that was really cleverly, you know, aesthetically linked. I thought there was a real kind of consistency in terms of what they were saying and how it was coming across. You know, it felt like a really intuitive, formal response to their story. And then the kind of the telling of the that kind of had a real kind of emotional weight in terms of the actors' performances, kind of drawing out what must have been kind of going on and kind of dramatizing that in each moment. And I thought, again, the casting, really, really good. Yeah, I'm a big fan of Barry Keoghan and Evan Peters in American Horror Story. I'm a big fan of American Horror Story, so it was nice to see that. And I saw the trailer for it when I saw BlacKkKlansman, and it felt like, okay, this is going to be a really entertaining and film. But the trailer kind of doesn't really engage with that documentary aspect. You know, it just basically presents it as this kind of straight heist thriller. And while I was watching it, as much as I was really kind of enjoying the formal stuff, the more human stuff, the moral stuff kind of left me a bit kind of questioning. It was interesting. I felt very similar to The Imposter, but much less problematic in terms of the way you tell that story, you know, the way you use cinematic language and cinema devices to tell that story. It felt much less problematic, but still the questions that come out of watching on screen people who have perpetrated a certain act felt kind of mishandled in some senses, and kind of towards the end I was a bit like, I need to know more about particularly the lead guy, but I think by that point the film had almost kind of got itself into a way of telling the story that would have meant a shift to being much more straight and sober, and the filmmaker then distancing themselves to say, actually, these are the problems with this person in terms of what they've done and how they see the world, would have been too much of a shift. So I could understand the choices that were made, even if at the end I was a bit like, and it was interesting to hear him talk about the real librarian's approach, and because that was a question like, where is this person who is clearly a victim in this? And then to see her kind of at the end felt a bit odd. So I think, but that's the great thing about Q&As, because I think that, you know, that my question is like, why is she not in it more? Why are we not hearing this voice? It feels, and then to understand actually, yeah, that the part of the process is that this person, that was it, you know, that's what you get. I thought that was kind of telling. And I was like, okay, that made me then think, actually, I can understand why you would make those other choices, because you have to make a choice about how you're going to tell it, because you don't have necessarily the access you want. And again, a problem of a real story as opposed to a one that you've kind of constructed from scratch. So yeah, so many interesting things about it. And overall, yeah, I thought it was really fun, but that kind of left me feeling a bit awkward, because I was like, I know there's probably more to this that's not fun, which again left a little bit of a weird taste. Yeah, that was my take on it.
That's a really interesting kind of reaction, because I mean, as you heard on the Q&A, when I was first watching it, I hadn't seen The Imposter. I watched The Imposter in lieu of watching this. And I wasn't sure whether the talking heads were setups themselves, because especially the lead guy was so full of himself and so performative. You know what I mean? I thought he could have been, like, it was almost as if the documentary footage had been set up. So I really liked it on that level of almost as a part of this wave of documentary films that are really sort of pointing to the how documentary as a form, its verisimilitude is very problematic. The mechanisms that we use or we assume to evoke a sense of truth and authenticity, whether it is talking heads or archival footage or whatever you use in the classic documentary sense, all of those are constructed aesthetics. I really enjoyed the way that he spliced together the mechanisms of documentary with the sort of more generic heist or just kind of, you know, fictional filmmaking techniques, really. And so there's formal elements that are being played with here that I think you could talk about that provoke conversation about how we understand what we're seeing on screen, what is the relationship between reality and representation, and what role does film and the filmmaker playing manipulating you to do that. So I think that you can sort of take it on that level. I thought that the actual sequences were really enjoyable. It was just really funny to see how, you know, that these sort of self-entitled young white guys, I mean, we can get to the sort of, again, the identity politics in a minute, but you know, these completely useless guys just thinking, oh yeah, we're going to set up this thing, and the way that they sort of organized it and the way that they kind of botched it the first time and then had to go back. That was all really good. And then there's that little one sequence where there's a sort of imagining the robbery being done in this really highly stylized way. I thought that was really, really good fun. I do agree with this, you in terms of the ending. It doesn't wrap up in a totally satisfying way, I don't think. But when it comes to these kinds of movies, well, I don't want to sort of call it a straight heist or a caper movie, because I think it's more than that. I think it's, you know, I watched Baby Driver and I think it's miles better than Baby Driver. I think it's a lot better than I mean, well, I don't want to say good and bad, but I enjoyed it. I think it's a much more satisfying movie than, say, Free Fire, for example, which we've talked about on the podcast. I think there's a lot more to it than that. But I don't think it reaches a sort of iconography that say something like Fight Club does, which I think it kind of aspires to be in many ways. And I think a lot of the main characters pontificating about what are our lives going to be as young white men, you know, we're going to be wage slaves for the rest of our lives. And there's that moment where he just he's in the school and he just tells the teacher, the gym teacher, you know, to go screw himself, because it's like he doesn't want to conform to this thing. So I think a lot of that was going on underneath. But interestingly, you know, talking to the director there, you know, he had a lot more footage, and I think that there was a lot more sort of, you know, social context, I think, that could have been wrapped around it. But in the at the end of the day, you know, I think that that was a, as he was saying, it's like you were saying as well, it's a directorial choice that you have to make at certain points. How didactic do you want it to be? How much do you want it to be on the nose that this is saying this about these young white men? And I think that for the most part, I think he gets the balance right.
Yeah, I just felt there was a lack of criticality at the end, you know, which kind of made me feel like he'd aligned himself too much with them when, yeah, they kind of pontificate about it. But they're all fine. They've been to prison, but essentially, as white men, they are, look at what they're doing now. You know, they're not really, you know, they're one's an artist, one's going to be a writer, one's doing filmmaking at college. Like, you know, they went to prison for a few years, and they're constantly doing things that are stupid. You know, but because the film has that heist sheen, and because it and them align themselves with heist movies, which all end in disaster, there's no sense that, like, The Killing and Rafifi don't end well, you know. But the film sort of presents the characters as engaged with, which they are. They're kind of taking the aspects of heist movies that they like, you know, and not thinking about the consequences. And that's kind of what they're doing as people. And I think at the end, I wanted a little bit more of the film to kind of at least question it, not necessarily kind of do a vault fast and say, oh, you know, because that would be disingenuous completely to the pro. But just where was the sense that, you know, because throughout you're going like, why should I care about these people? These people are spoiled. They're, you know, they're not from the worst backgrounds in the world, comparatively speaking. What's it really about? And then at the end, it's like, well, you know, and again, because you have that little glimpse of the librarian, I think if you don't have her, then that question is always like, well, there's a, you know, but bringing her in, it's like, well, someone's still affected by this, and the people who did it are not, you know, they've kind of moved on and done kind of okay for themselves. So those were the things that I thought didn't, but, you know, you sort of talking about Fight Club, you know, Fight Club, you know, was made by an absolute master, but I think it's more confident in what it's setting out to do in a way that this isn't. And I think that's because it's an early film. It's only a second feature, you know, and someone who's making a shift from doc work to a more narrative mode, you know. I think a lot of that stuff is, I don't have any hang-ups about it. It doesn't make the enjoyment of some of the formal achievements any less. I agree with the Baby Driver thing. I think it's, which is more interesting because it's both taking established genre stuff and bringing something new into the mix. Yeah, and I can see why you liked it. When I watched the trailer and you sort of said, oh, you're going to interview this guy, it was like, doesn't seem like a Dario film, which made it kind of interesting. And then watching it, I was like, oh, I can see, this has a lot of things that we talk about a lot in it that I can see you sort of gravitate towards. So, yeah, and like I say, just watching that blend of doc and narrative modes was, I thought, for the most part, really, really well handled. But the problem is with wild documentary and what the film is sort of saying is that, you know, largely it's kind of aesthetics as much as anything else and a way of, you know, giving information. There is also an underlying human aspect to it that has to be reckoned with, you know, in a way that something like The Act of Killing, which kind of it felt,
oh god, it's not that,
like,
yeah.
Doing similar, yeah, 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 I mean? But it's kind of saying that these people are performers, and we are giving them to a degree the chance to perform out, not an atrocity in the same way, but certainly a crime, and that's interesting the way that kind of doc shift is happening, and then to where The Act of Killing obviously puts them in the position of recreating and this kind of bringing in Hollywood stars to, I think, is just really fascinating in terms of in terms of the moment that we're in. I think it's a really timely film in terms of, you know, in terms of narrative and story. Yeah, so,
I mean,
lots going on, and I hope people
really does sit in this kind of, you know, self-entitlement, alt-right universe, doesn't it? I mean, I think it's so interesting to watch it in that context. And maybe, like, I find myself bringing that in terms of, like, thinking, you know, these are really, you know, these characters are total assholes, but yet they're, their sense of themselves and then their complete misreading of their own abilities in terms of like entitlement and being able to do this, and how there doesn't seem to be any vision of anything outside themselves. Because I think it's really interesting. I mean, we talked in the last episode about who speaks for who, and in this film there are hardly any women and no people of color really, but that's how it should be, because in this particular film, because it is they are in this self-obsessed narcissistic bubble of themselves, and it's kind of reflexive of that in the way that makes sense to me anyway.
Yeah, I just think he's a bit overly seduced
maybe,
by it.
Maybe. Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? I get it. So, but he's really critical. There's a real criticality in terms of the form, which I think is great. You know, like that juxtaposition of forms helps it not be, oh God, this guy loves these guys. Do you know what I mean?
I get what you're saying. I mean, just talking to him, I think, and again, some of the conversations we had that were outside the Q&A, I think he's more fascinated with incredible stories. If you look at the imposter, you know, things that you would just say, you know, that could never be made into a film because nobody would ever believe it. And, you know, and I think that's more of the
And I think
than in a way, I'm kind of half in love with this subject. But in a way, it's funny, that's what film does. I mean, no matter how horrible a film might be or the subject matter might be, the fact that a film has been made about it automatically kind of can glorify it, maybe almost unintentionally, just by it being made. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it kind of elevates it to a status which suggests it's worthy of kind of engagement. Yeah, which I agree with. And I think it's at its best when it's kind of enthralled to the story, you know, and how to tell the story. Yeah,
brilliant. Well, thanks for that chat, Neil, and I hope we enjoyed this little extra episode that we slipped in, because it did come up out of nowhere, so it was thought we'd take the opportunity. I look forward to seeing you again very soon. We have a very exciting episode coming up next. Neil, do you want to just tip our hat to that?
Yeah, so next up we are going to be talking about Jane Campion. So this week down in Falmouth, as part of Freshers Week, I've invited Ellen Cheshire, who's a big fan of the podcast and has just written a new book on Jane Campion in the scene, to come down and talk about all things Jane Campion. And we're going to screen the BFI's reissue of The Piano for its 25th anniversary. So a lovely, beautiful screening of The Piano and all things Campion will be up.
I might go to the BFI and watch that.
Yeah, I've seen it for a while. So, another film I'm absolutely excited to see on the big screen.
We will be back very soon. Please keep listening. Please keep commenting. You can talk to us on Twitter. We're usually on there various parts of the day. You can email us at cinematologists@gmail.com. And of course, if you feel so inclined, please support us on the Patreon website. You can head over there and subscribe to our bonus material. We do have an episode coming up on the Cold War where I'll be talking to a listener to the podcast. That'll be coming up very soon, and it is only $2.50 a month, so anybody who can spare that small amount to help us with our running costs here, we'd really appreciate it. Neil, take care, all the best, good luck with Freshers.
Thanks, you too, speak to you soon.
This has been the Cinematologist podcast. Thanks for listening.
Tumble and find they are beautiful. On the hilltops at night, they are beautiful. And blazing with light is the whitest and the tallest and